You're listening to Red Compass After Hours, the podcast where the best and brightest of the financial services industry let their hair down, unbutton their collars, and share what they really think about payments. I'm Mike Truter, Director of Digital Ecosystems and Innovation at Red Compass, and in each episode, I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Julie Getter. Let's kick things off. It's now time to welcome today's featured guest, Stanley Young, Head of Product Design at Onyx. I had the pleasure of working with Stanley on Project Ubin, a project he conceptualized and brought to life for the Monetary Authority of Singapore. Project Ubin explored central bank digital currency for cross-border payments. In the past, Stanley served as global CTO for IBM Blockchain for Financial Services, and prior to his current role, he led Deloitte's Southeast Asia Blockchain Lab.
Welcome, Stanley. Wonderful that you could join us all the way from Singapore.
Excited to be here.
Lovely to have you here. As this is an after-hours chat, I hope everyone has brought a drink. Today, I'm enjoying a drop of South African Chenin Blanc. Julie, what's your tipple today?
I have to say I have a boring tea today because we are adjusting to Stanley time and it's still morning for us.
fair enough. And Stanley, what's waiting your whistle this evening?
I had green tea.
You have green tea, okay. Well, I'm the outsider this week. Okay, let's get going. As a reminder, the format for After Hours is simple. To add a little bit of spice and spontaneity, Julie and I don't yet know what the topic is. Instead, Stanley will pick the topic from a huge list, and then without any script or preparation, we see where the conversation will take us. There's only one rule. Like the Scottish knife, the ski and do, we need to keep things short, sharp, and to the point. And now the moment we've all been waiting for, Stanley's topic. Let me pop the list of topics up for us to choose from. Give me a second. There we go. Okay, Stanley, here's the moment of truth. Which topic are you going to select from the crystal ball?
I will go for the one at the bottom right-hand corner, real-time sanction screening.
Real-time sanction screening it is. Great. Okay, real-time sanction screening. Where shall we start? Julie, what is real-time sanction screening and why is it important?
Real-time sanction screening is the ability to effectively check whether the beneficiary of the payments is a bad guy, to put it simply. And I think like it's a very interesting and important topic at the moment because with instant payment, it's becoming quite crucial and critical to be able to do real-time sanction screening on the fly, effectively, and be able to then process the payment to stop it, particularly because like if you are suspicious about the beneficiary, the bank cannot tip off their customer about this. So that's why it's quite critical to be able to do that. So far, with the instant schemes that we've seen, we didn't like have really the issue because it was domestic. However, when you go into regional instant scheme, it's becoming quite crucial.
Okay, Stanley, I'm going to ask now, why did you pick this topic? What was the reason behind your choice?
A couple of things that are interesting about this topic, right? So I think of real time as one of the biggest problems with everything that we hope to do. So what real time means often is something like a few seconds or under a minute, right? And I think Julie brings up a good point that the delay happens to give people information, right? So her concern, or the concern that she's brought up, is that you may be tipping someone off about a sanctions hit, for example, if the processing of a transaction takes longer than the expected amount of time, which could be, you know, 5 seconds, 15 seconds, whatever it is. And so that's an interesting perspective to me, and why this whole topic seems both mysterious and seems like something that we can delve into.
Okay. So if I can ask you a question, just kind of keeping on the instant side, obviously you have a long history and deep understanding of DLT, the distributed ledger technology, and blockchain in particular, where things really do happen instantly, right? Everything is an atomic transaction happening at once. So how does the kind of instant sanction screening happen in that kind of scenario?
So I think actually it doesn't all happen atomically. So it's a choice whether we want things to happen atomically, and there are multiple ways to build transaction flows or transaction life cycles where we could have pauses for sanction screening. So one very effective way to do this is to do everything before you start processing it on the blockchain, for example, right? So if you look at Stellar and the model that works within the Stellar blockchain, right, the recommended way for sanction screening or any kind of screening is to do this before you send the transaction through the system. So it's built around how you need to collect multiple signatures before the transaction gets posted into the blockchain, right? So as part of the collection of the signatures, everyone's actually attesting that they've done the required work around checks. So you know, that's one way. That's the most extreme way, probably, in that you can still retain some form of real-time-like behavior because, again, the service level agreements that the clearing system or the processing system give to you actually affect what's happening here, right? So do you design everything so that you go through a multi-step process before it's recorded on your database, whether it's a blockchain or some other database? Or do you want to do everything before and then just do one simple operation at the end?
Julie, any thoughts? Any concerns you see with that approach, or is it still instant if you're doing all the work up front?
Yeah, and for me, like Stanley, when you were basically like explaining all of this and so on, like I have to say that I'm a bit desperate when we talk about like real time sanction screening, because I feel like we are only catching 1% of the financial crime, something like that. So definitely it's not like really efficient. Two, we've been, I think, waiting for more collaboration in this space for ages. So I think like somehow, you know, like blockchain was kind of, potentially the light at the end of the tunnel. But actually with what you just explained, mentioning that there is a lot of pre-screening before, it's basically exactly the same problem that needs to be addressed. So do you see, like, my question is then, with COVID, there have been definitely an increase of financial crime, cyber fraud, and so on. So have you seen an increase in collaboration or a way to then, do things differently in this space to reach more efficiency? Because again, 1%, I mean, come on, we can do better, right?
Yeah. What's the solution? No pressure, Sam.
So, I mean, a friend of mine teaches with me at one of the local universities, right, when we lecture about RegTech. And I think the great wish for RegTechs is often to apply some form of automation to solve compliance issues. And this is an example where it almost always seems like someone will bring up AI or some kind of machine learning tool in pattern recognition for names, right, in sanction screening, making it much faster, for example. So the idea is you throw fancier technology at it and you can solve it better. But I mean, I think in terms of collaboration, that's a good idea. It's just that I suspect a lot of regulation has to be harmonized around how we deal with it. So for example, the Wolfsburg sanction screening guidance is, you know, from 2019 and so on earlier. I'll talk about broad principles for something like real-time sanction screening, right? But I think the, I mean, admittedly, with many more transactions, then you have a lot more volume to screen, and you're going to miss more events, right? Or you're going to have a lot more false positives is the most likely thing. And I think ultimately, most of the technology we apply is to reduce the incidence of false positives so that you can spend the time on the true positives more fruitfully. And it's a losing game, I would say. Most of the time, the technology that we employ is still not going to do very well when you have a lot of, let's say, determined people in and intermediaries, right? Ready to get around the control. So I by definition, this problem is, I suspect the whole idea of sanction screening itself is as Julie suggests, just one part of the solution. You need many more things, right? So sanction screening should not be the be all and end all of reducing financial crime and access to by say unsuitable actors.
I guess that's a sad truth, really, isn't it? That criminals will always be more innovative, and whatever you do to kind of block a path, their level of innovation is amazing to find a way around the controls and figure it out. And so there's always got to be not just the sanction screening, but I guess the profiling in the background of the data that you have, finding ways and measures that can constantly improve the algorithms to kind of minimize it. You can't, I guess, is it a case that we will never be able to eradicate it? Hoping we can do that with COVID, but maybe like the polio case, no matter how we try, I know
Julie. I was thinking about that Julie's actually
big,
when you said.
Fan of inside Bill's brain, I think the Bill Gates series where it looks at kind of eradication of polio, and it's hard, right? It's one of those things, but it's been done for things like smallpox. So is it possible? Are we doing enough? Julie, what do you think?
I think for me, like, and Stanley, you raised a good point around false positive. And I have to say, I know it's hard, don't get me wrong, but on one end, if I look at this from, someone who don't know about the background complexity, if you look at the result, it's just mind-blowing, the number of false positive we have. So the number of transactions that are basically stopped or caught, but then they are false positive. So the real criminal transactions are going through and we're stopping the wrong run. So I'm just do we need, when I say collaboration, do we need a different type of collaboration or a different way to profile people? Where not only we use the standard list and so on, but we enrich it with, activity on social media, this type of thing, basically looking at different sources of information. Because I feel like even if you apply some technology like machine learning and so on, right? Today, the quality of the data to be able to do that is not there. Okay, it will be better with the ISO 22 migration, but reality is the amount of work you basically need to do to be able to screen properly the data is massive. So criminals have time to move on and try a new technique to basically find a way to go through. So what is your opinion on this?
It's always, I think using non-traditional data sources is the great white hope, right? Many, I'm sure Mike was hearing bits of that earlier, maybe. The truth is that the more data we bring in, the more we have to deal with probably false positives and false matches, right? Because the thing is that we start to impinge on having to define what is normal and what is abnormal in terms of your total, say, social media presence. And that gets into all kinds of problematic areas, potentially, of bias, of undesirable redlining, almost, right, of certain types of people, right? And that can be extremely unfair and result in, you know, I think, backlash against such techniques. So we have to be quite measured in how we approach this. Right? So there is a sincere need to reduce financial crime, but at the same time, you're balancing this against people's desire to lead their lives without fear that, you know, they would be judged, right, on aspects of what they do that are really potentially not relevant to the transaction at hand. So if you think about Singapore, some of the worries that people have had, right, with the Trace Together token. That's an example, right? The Trace Together token, I mean, there was a commitment by the government that the data would not be used for anything other than contact tracing. And then it turned out that the data could be used and is being used for serious crimes under the Criminal Procedures Act, right? So the thing is that, you know, people have started to resist the use of this token in some cases, right? I mean, at least in the profile in the newspapers. So I think, again, as Mike was saying, there's this, as you look at additional new things, and people are always going to innovate around gaming that system. And so that usefulness of the non-traditional data starts to fall off, I think, in many of these cases. And then you start getting into a whole cost-benefit question around, do we really need to look at this data? And then what do we do with it? Because you know as well as I do now that social media itself can be a source of fake news, right? And can drive behaviors that are unusual. Yeah. So how much do you trust the data that's there anyway?
That's a good point. And I guess we have to think about personal data privacy as well. I mean, it is significant. And like you say, it can be abused. One of the topics that Julie and I have thrown about a little bit is thinking about digital identity. And, you know, Singapore's got the fantastic MyInfo, you know, where the government's taken initiatives to kind of get clean data that really can help, you know, clarify who people are. Do you think enough's being done by governments around the world to kind of create these repositories of trusted data?
Well, I think it's a function of, that's a complicated question because different countries and different societies have different notions of what government does. And in fact, government at many different levels exists in different countries. And, you know, the experience of Singapore as a city state is going to be very different from someone who lives in China, for example, where there's a provincial, local government, the city government, and then the federal, I mean, in China, the central government, right? So any kinds of these systems will hit limits around what that particular government that you're dealing with has about you. And so again, Mike, I'm sure you've got multiple identities equivalently, right? You've got an identity that's visible to the UK government versus the one that's visible to the Singapore government, and they're going to differ in some cases. And so the information that we gather about you, I think, you know, depending on where you are at a single point in time, you might regret having that information being held by a government, right? That, so again, there are governments with which you don't want any information about you to be shared, right? Potentially. Right, and for them to hold on to that information, even if for legitimate reasons within the law of their country, it may not be something you want, right? So for example, I mean, I'm sure, there are lots of countries where there are mutual sanctions against each other, and then certain information being held is going to be troublesome. So it's not a simple thing to deal with.
It's not black and white. It's a very cloudy issue, isn't it? And Julie, I mean, we've spoken a lot about trust, right? And who do you trust? And I think Stanley's point, you know, sometimes, you know, people trust their government, sometimes they might not, or the data. But in a cross-border payments scenario, right, you have to trust someone, right? Is there a way forward? I mean, any way we can is it going to be different governments saying, I trust you, you trust me, therefore, you know, we find a way to allow instant sanction screening coming back?
I think you know, the way we seem to deal with it normally is that we've got information that's carried within the narrative of the message, right? So this is a pure messaging based flow where we send basically a package of data about the transaction through the system, and that package is being seen and inspected by everyone along, right, the chain. Now that's one way, and that the other way, of course, is the model that you talked about, which is that potentially you don't send the information as a package at all, but you send a kind of identifier that different entities along the path can use to reference information about the entities transacting, right, in that transaction. But they only read the information that is relevant to them. So that's another kind of intriguing possibility, right? That it's a combination of who I am as the processor along this chain and who you are as one of the entities making use of my services that allows me to see relevant things about you and not more than that. Because the original approach with the packet of information is like everyone gets the same information, whether they need to know or not, right? And it's sent along. So, I mean, the second way seems innately preferable. And, you know, there are definitely models that have been built out using blockchain where sovereign identity with identity wallets, for example, a way to potentially do that second flow, right? And then you reduce the need to trust entities along the way, not to look at information that's not relevant to the task that they're doing, right? And you only review exactly what needs to be reviewed to them, and probably with zero knowledge proofs. Again, you might not even have to reveal the underlying data elements. You just have to provide a proof that the underlying data elements do not fall within some list or are okay. So there are lots of things that we can try to do that reduce the need to trust. You know, you started off by asking about governments, but you can trust any entity not to misuse that information, because the information never goes in the first place.
And then I guess from a privacy perspective, if you own your own identification, then you can choose, right? You have the choice to share or not to share, to speed up or allow the transaction to settle quickly.
I think it's a second layer of trust, right? Because the thing is that you control that information about you up to the point that you give it to someone else. So I've given you my name, my email address. Now I got to trust you, even though I trusted you before to just have that information. Now I have to trust that in future you do not misuse that information, right? It only goes up if I'm revealing the actual information to you. There's only so much protection and assurance I can get. The consent to use it once is not going to prevent you from using it a second, third, fourth, fifth time, even if in, you know, not in the context that I originally authorized you to do so.
Understood.
I think though it's nice to see like kind of evolution in this space as well. Like if you think of some of the big techs, right, where it was a matter of like, oh yeah, we're sharing all the data and so on. Actually, I don't know if you you two noticed like the latest Apple functionality where, you know, when if let's say I want to download a new app, register to this new app, I can use my Apple ID and then I have the option not to share my email address anymore, so that you know, I control effectively the data that is being shared with the app. And I think this is quite nice. So I feel like Apple is moving more and more into the space of controlling the data you display, yet having enough data, or like being at the end the trusted entity.
Yeah, Apple becomes the trusted entity.
To identify you, right?
Yeah, so the thing is that the app provider has to trust Apple has done its job, right?
Which
is the quid pro quo in this case. And I think that's another more intriguing case that I could bring up with respect to this, exactly this, which is that, so if I've got a information that's now shared about transactions over time, so this is the time notion is the problem. Right, that now Mike and I transact, and we transact often. Now, is Mike, even without, so Julie, you come along, and then you ask Mike, is Stan trusted by you, Mike? And then Mike can only answer in two ways. One is, I have dealt with Stan in the past, and I have dealt with him within the range of, say, 100 times. And then you make your own value judgment about that, right?
Yeah.
So the fact that Mike had 100 interactions with me in the past is known to you now. Or he can respond, I do not wish to respond. Okay. So he's got two choices. Now, what does that tell about, you know, the authorization, the consent by me, for example? Have I authorized Mike to tell you that he's, you know, even that little bit of information about me that he's dealt with me in the past and interacted maybe 100 times within that range. Is that even something that he's authorized to do, to reveal to anyone? And I think that is a big question, because that is being suggested as a potential, you know, even with zero knowledge proofs, that's one of the potential things that people are talking about when it comes to attesting to, you know, so for screening and pre-processing or validation of transactions, right? That's one of the things that people might expect the bank to do. So you ping the counterparty bank and you say, have you ever dealt with my user? And then they can't tell, I mean, and you know, they can't give you a value judgment because they're not meant to, but they can say, I don't wish to tell you anything about my user, or I have dealt with him and he exists, right? So that is, are they even allowed to share that information?
It's like a job reference, right? When you leave your employer, they can't say anything bad, but they can say he worked from this date to this date. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, in some law. So again, this is a value judgment that each society, each country will make on its own. And again,
so many variations, right? Sorry,
Judy. That's an interesting point as well, because kind of go further with your example. Again, I think there is a notion of trust issue. Like, if you tell me, ask my trotter about my reference, I would be like, I don't trust Mike. There is no way to ask him. So then,
yes, exactly. So the thing is that it reflects on, you know, when Mike Truther responds back to Julie about his reaction to Stan, it is a value judgment. It's an interesting thing, right? Because the thing is that it reflects both Julie's trust of Mike as well as Mike's, as much as Mike's trust of Stan. And so it becomes a kind of, you know, are we still really explaining? I mean, are we still really attesting to the thing that we wanted to know, which is Stan a good person, right? So we aren't, right? It's because now wrapped around a lot of other notions of trust.
But Stan's a good person because Mike's a good person, right? Isn't that what we're saying?
Yeah, so that transitive closure thing is essentially it, right? That we trust. Today we deal with this webs of trust, right? That jump along this thing.
But that's the thing as well. I think it's interesting because if you tell me, okay, ask Mike only, and then rely on Mike only. It's my personality. I guess I would struggle with that. But if you tell me, ask I don't know, Mike, Jack, Ben, and so on, and they will all tell you about me, then I would be like, okay. Potentially Stan can be trusted. But that means that you as Stan, you need to share more information about yourself with more people effectively. So that come back to point zero about privacy, right?
Yeah. So then you're back to the social media thing, and who's the most popular with the most friends is the judge.
Exactly. So again, you know, a motivated person. I'm sure the thing is, the truth is that people who are spies or, you know, state-sponsored actors can always win that meme. You can always do better than the rest of us.
You can always buy bots as well.
Yeah, I just watched the spies on Netflix, and definitely it matched what you just said.
Okay, this is a fascinating topic, and I want to talk for hours. I think there's so much that's come up here that actually we need a follow up conversation somewhere to kind of keep doing these. But it is time for us to wrap up, guys. Thank you so much for your thoughts and Stan, brilliant topic and brilliant conversation and a lot there for us to think about. So thanks for joining us today for the After Hours chat. It's really great to see you again and chat. It's always a pleasure talking to someone who's knowledgeable and passionate about payments. And I've really missed these regular chats on these kinds of topics. So we've got to do it more often.
Thanks for listening to Red Compass After Hours. If you've enjoyed this discussion, then please show your support by subscribing and leaving us a review on your favorite podcast player. That's all for this episode. See you next time.